Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world offers unending digital distraction to today's teenagers. Can teens still turn off the screens and lose themselves, find themselves, in a good book? Learn to love it, love reading, find life lessons that make them better people and citizens. New Yorker writer David Denby set out to find out. He went back to high school and watched teachers and students wrangle over reading and books. This hour on Point, David Denby, and what it takes now to get teens to read. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Parents, teachers, teens, what's your experience? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is David Denby, staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Denby, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. You've got these three great quotes at the front piece of the book. First, Ray Bradbury, the great science fiction writer, novelist, who said, "You don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. Just get people to stop reading them."
Right.
And then George R.R. Martin,
says,
"A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies. The man who never reads lives only one." Ooh, so inspiring. And then you quote a student, age 15, New Haven, Connecticut. Simple as this. The student says, "Books smell like old people." Oh, no.
Tom,
what are you up to
that,
here?
When I heard that sentence, I said, oh, God, you know.
God, read it on your Kindle, then. Read it on your Kindle, then.
That is material. Boy, you are material, son.
Wow.
Yeah, he was an interesting kid. He had learning problems. This was up in New Haven at the Hill House School, James Hill House School, inner city school in New Haven. A teacher let him in the class, even though officially he was supposed to be in a special class with kids with learning problems and disabilities. And he sort of faded in and out during the year, but when he was in, he was devastating and often very trenchant, as in that remark. And he was one of my favorite students. So when he said that, I thought, oh, my God, he's just epitomized an attitude that, you know, is very widespread.
We want to hear what you're up to. We've got a little bit of clip here. NPR's paid attention to this. They were out in Washington, D.C. A year and a half ago or so. They talked to Shimaka Anoski, ninth grader at the Wilson High School. This is Washington. And here's what she does with her free time, not reading.
I don't really read for pleasure. Generally, I talk on the phone or I watch, like, Netflix shows or Hulu shows, just, like, mostly TV. That's it.
First sentence there, she kind of swallowed it. I don't really read for pleasure.
Well, there you have it. I mean, she couldn't have said it better. Pleasure is the issue, isn't it? I mean, if you love reading, you will read constantly. If you think it's a chore or just one activity among others, and that's the way she talked is the attitude I kept hearing, including some very, very bright kids. Well, yeah, there's, you know, doing the laundry and taking care of my kid brother, making him lunch, you know, and seeing friends. Oh, yeah, and there's reading. Sure, yeah. You know, it's like that. It's just one activity among others. It's not something which enfolds everything else, which I think was, you know, the best kids of earlier generations thought they and grown-ups now think, I always have to have a book going. Right? You have to have something going. You may not read it steadily or regularly. I mean, it may be something high, something low, but you've always got something going in your life that's a book that you're going to turn to, whether listening to it in the car or listening to it in bed or reading it. That is gone. And that's what scares me, that nexus between reading and pleasure, reading and need. In this generation, you heard what she said. I mean, she's got so many screens, you know, she can look on her smartphone, you know, at shows that she's missed. She can text, she can talk to friends. You know, you walk into a sandwich shop, Tom, or into the mall, and you see four kids sitting around a table, and they're all holding smartphones. And I noticed this particularly because the kids had hoods on. They looked like monks or druids or something, and they were all they were all leaning towards the center of the table, Tom, and the phones were almost touching.
But maybe they've got Dostoevsky on their screen.
Yeah, right.
maybe not.
Maybe not. Well, this is a secondary. This is another issue which Sherry Turkle has written about, is the absence of conversation.
Leave that aside. We got that. I mean, that's an issue. We've got already. Books is big enough, I guess. And I'm the wrong one to ask. I mean, I was so enchanted with reading. I was so deep in the books. You know, that was my child. If I wasn't baling hay or somewhere down in the creek, if I could possibly be there, it was nose in a book. Do you have evidence that, by and large, American young people are just missing that experience now? I mean, it was never everybody. You know, my cousin, maybe it wasn't his thing. It was for me. Maybe it's the same percentage who get captivated today.
I don't think I'm being a fool. I know there was never any mythical golden age of teen reading, right?
Yep.
When everyone was reading Jane, all girls were reading Jane Eyre and all boys were reading, well, you mentioned Bradbury, that would be a good one, or Jack Kerouac, or Mark Twain. There was always a minority. My guess is that it's now smaller because the shame of not reading has been removed. As I said, it's simply one activity among others. Take it or leave it. But I think that it would be awful if the next generation grew smaller still among those who needed to read. Now, it doesn't mean that it's all over at 15, right? I mean, people change. People wake up. People are struck by something when they're 30. But I mean, apart from childhood, when your parents can hold you and read to you, which is the best time to learn to love reading, school, I thought, would be the next best place. And to look at 15-year-olds in particular, I stuck in a single 10th grade English class in Manhattan for an entire year, public school. Good public school, mixed kids, ethnically mixed, income family mixed. I didn't want them all rich or all poor. I wanted to see, you know, and see what a terrific teacher, who I think we're going to talk to later, working hard with them could do for them. And some of them were very grudging non-readers at the beginning and got pulled into it. And it was partly his methods and his way of challenging them that did it. So, in other words, it's not all over. You can be reclaimed for serious reading if you're lucky with the right teacher.
We're going to look
at the right books.
Yeah, we're going to look at how you jumped in there, what you saw, what they read, how it worked. But let's just stipulate right up front: you personally see the stakes here as very high. I mean, we talked about reading and pleasure, and that is no small thing. But you're quoting Bradbury here about the culture itself, the deep understanding of the culture and the world. That can be communicated through books, and you're very clear that you fear a loss of that.
Well, there's never been more information out there than now, and I don't want to be hypocritical about this. I'm on the internet many hours every day. I do like to read books also, but this enormous amount of information and an enormous amount of selling, enormous amount of opinion, a lot of sort of flavored and unreliable partisan stuff. We see that particularly in a political season. And I mean, the thing that reading does is to give, if you're reading something good, something more authoritative in some way that also plugs into yourself. That you say, who am I? What am I doing with my life? What do I really believe? What do I really know about the First World War? It's just a much deeper experience than this constant excitement of the media, which, believe me, Tom, you and I are part of it, you know, and producers of it in our way, in different ways. But I also fear it, and I think a culture that gets more and more shallow in its assumptions and its excitements is not good. And I think you're seeing that in the political arena right now, and part of it at any rate.
So you spent the better
essentially
part.
Entertainment and media have taken over the politics. So yes, it's there's a very big thing at stake here. I'll put it tautologically, every great civilization has had a great literature, including our own, the 19th century and the 20th century stuff, and we've got great writers now. I just want that to survive.
So you spent the better part of an academic year diving into three schools, 10th grades. Name and describe those three schools for us, David.
Well, the Beacon School, which I mentioned before, is a public school. They were all public schools in New York. Mm-hmm. And it has mixed race and mixed family wealth students, poor, rich, poor, prosperous, and middle class, lots of Latinos.
Mm-hmm. And then a well-to-do suburb of New York in Mamaroneck.
Then I was in a well-to-do suburb of New York, Mamaroneck, which was doing something very different that I was interested in. Mamaroneck, which is about 30 miles north of New York.
Up by Scarsdale and all that, yeah.
Exactly. Predominantly white upper middle class, although there are Latinos there who are often servants in the fancy white houses. Anyway, the administration there discovered that a lot of their kids weren't actually doing the reading. They were looking at Spark Notes, which is a very competent online study.
Summaries.
What we used to call a trot in my day. Right. And they were listening in class, brazening it out on the exams. So instead of screaming at them, as past teachers would have, and, you know, penalizing, they tried something different. And then
we're going to look at what that was in the third school, New Haven, Connecticut, and not a privileged school.
Not
a population.
New Haven was an inner city school, very poor kids, mainly African American. At the beginning of the year, they weren't eager to read at all. They simply wouldn't do the reading. And the teacher started reading with them in class, and they read To Kill a Mockingbird all the way through. And by the end of the year, they were choosing books to read. I mean, that's a very interesting story, I think.
We'll look at all three stories. David Denby is with us, New Yorker writer. His new book is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives, about how American teens today in this digital age might be led to reading. Little video game theme behind us, Call of Duty, plenty of that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are talking this hour about what it takes now to get American teens to read the books, the teachers, the effort to get to the thrill of good reading in the digital age. New Yorker writer David Denby spent a year in three schools, three classrooms, watching three teachers do the work of breaking through or trying. Behind us right here, marching band from one of those schools, Hill House High School in New Haven, Connecticut, performing Tear It Up at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New Haven last year. But getting kids to read these days when there are so many digital options, it's a big challenge. You can join us this hour. What does it take to make reading irresistible these days, to make a book as riveting as a smartphone, at least for a while? Teachers, parents, what do you see? What's your experience? Are the kids reading? Are they all right? And teens, what do you see with your peers? How do you feel about getting lost in a book? A couple of decades ago now, David Denby wrote about great books, and adults went back and read them himself for his book, Great Books. Now he's out with Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. We're going to hear how they did what. Of course, we know the ideal, 1989, Dead Poets Society. Teacher John Keating, played by Robin Williams, tells his class of young men there why they should read poetry.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. And medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
Substitute great books for poetry, and you've got the idea. We've got callers for you already, David. We'll hear what you learned. Sarah in Westerly, Rhode Island. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm really excited to read this book, Lit Up. I'm in my first year of teaching in higher education, and man, it's a problem. And one of the things that I noticed, both as a parent now for 22 years and now as a new educator, is that these kids cannot read or write, and it seems that they're not being taught either, and they ought to be taught together from the very beginning.
What's the evidence you're seeing that they can't read, Sarah? They're in college by the time you get them. Surely they can read.
It's economics, Tom. These kids are getting into these schools because the schools need the tuition to survive.
Yeah, but they got some kind of a test that they passed. I mean, you say they can't read. Yeah. Surely they can read.
They can't read. They cannot read. They can read a few letters and a few words, but they don't understand the full context of what they're reading. They do not read critically. They do not read between the lines.
What grade are you teaching? What grade are you teaching?
I teach students anywhere from 18 to 40 years old.
So we're talking higher ed. Okay, maybe it's worse.
Yes.
Sarah, you've really got us on the run of fear now. But all right, so the problem, there's the attestation, there's a problem. David, you dealt with teachers who are assigned to, you know, bring them into reading. Give us a sense of how they did it. We're going to talk to one of them in a few minutes, but what did you see in the classroom? What worked? What didn't? What was the challenge?
Well, if you have students who don't want to read, or don't do the assignments, then you have to just start reading in class to them, you know, dramatize the text, whatever it is, and then try to pull them in to read and get them to talk about how the text relates to their own lives. So if it's To Kill a Mockingbird, you can talk to them about being poor. And the book is set in Alabama, right, in the 1920s, but you can talk to them about their own lives, about mixed up families, about violence in the community, and then you go back to reading again. So, in other words, you pull them in. That's what I saw a teacher do in New Haven at the Hill House High School with kids who really weren't reading much of anything. And after this exercise, they sort of caught on, and eventually they began reading other things that she gave them: a Hemingway story, Vonnegut story. Eventually, long books that they chose. But that took, I admit, a whole academic year. But she began by reading with them, reading to them, and getting them to read aloud.
Books smell like old people, one of them told you. We've got a listener, Kathy, writes online to us. I don't know if she's being ironic or doubting your premise. She says, in that sort of formation that's popular now, because it's really hard to get the generation that grew up with Harry Potter, Twilight, and the Hunger Games to read. Maybe she's saying, look, they do read. They read all that, and you're ignoring it. Or maybe she's saying, those aren't worthy reads. I'm not sure.
No, I think a lot of them have read it. The question is whether they go on. And so one of the things you do is that you look at what those books are like, and you notice that they're fascinated by the dark side. That kids have this sort of fascination with disaster, with dystopian fiction. So you work with that rather than just trying to, you know, apply some Victorian notion of, you know, you should really be pursuing the noble and the true and the good. You work with that. They're interested in the dark side. Well, here, you know, here's this guy Edgar Allan Poe. Here's this guy Robert Louis Stevenson. You know, they wrote dark tales, Hawthorne's The Minister's Black Veil is a very spooky, scary stuff. Or you can do dystopian literature like 1984, Orwell, or Huxley's Brave New World. That makes a great pair. I mean, two different totalitarian societies, one held by in place by pain, the other by pleasure. In other words, you work with the interests that the kids have, which are indicated by the reading that she mentioned, fantasy, dystopia, and you enlarge it.
Give us some more moments that you saw when you saw teachers finding something extraordinary in terms of effectiveness in breaking through, or students opening up in a notable way.
Well, Leon, who we're going to talk to in a while, gave them one of the toughest books ever written to read, in which is Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground,
yeah,
a short novel.
But such a great
book. And it's about a very perverse guy who's extremely intelligent and is living in a state of nullity. And the kids were fascinated by him and by the kind of self-destruction that ran through his very great intelligence. And it brought them to an understanding of some of their own impulses. And he had them act out. We created a kind of little scene where, I mean, they would read parts of the book aloud, but then he just got a dialogue going in which they assumed the role of the different characters in the book, and they challenged each other. And that went on, and it got quite heated. I mean, they departed from the text, God knows, but that didn't matter. The point was to get them into the spirit of the novel and to assume a kind of personae of the novel in their own lives. So they actually started talking about college and other things. So it departed from Dostoevsky. But I thought that was an amazing breakthrough. So the spirit of Notes from Underground, which is a very difficult book and generations have struggled with, got into their souls at that moment. That was quite startling.
I mean, you talk about teachers reading to their students until the students take over and read for themselves. And I remember that very well. But in my experience, it seems to me that was in fourth grade that was what was going on.
Well, if kids are behind, you know, in their reading skills, that's what you have to do. This is the thing. We keep touching on it. You have to forge the link between reading and pleasure or reading and need. Either one. If it's pleasure that, you know, it's just greater than other pleasures. It gives you more excitement than just looking at, doing social media all day. If it's need, it's because it tells you something about who am I? What in the world am I doing in this life? How do I fit into this society? I feel upset and oppressed. I mean, we're seeing this politically right now by grown-up life. And there's a kind of maybe a bleak or difficult picture. At 15 is really a period of existential self-definition. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids do. And the literature is a very good way of engaging that.
And you're saying if they read Dickens or Twain, they might look at our political discourse in a different way, a more knowing way about human nature.
I'll be tendentious, all right? Tendentious and political. If everyone had read Dickens and Twain with all the con artists and everything, this culture wouldn't take Donald Trump seriously for a second. What he's doing is right out of Huckleberry Finn with the con artist. So, yes. I think Twain is telling us a great deal about, you know, what American life was like in Huckleberry Finn, and that was written in the 1880s.
Were there differences between these three schools in the students' openness to the books? I mean, these are different environments. There are different microcultures in their level of openness and in what worked for teachers.
Yeah, I mean, the Beacon students, Manhattan were on their way. Most of them were on their way to college, and some of them, possibly even, you know, intellectual professions. They were fairly well informed about how the world works. I mean, they had a little sense of history of the economy around school. The inner city kids in New Haven, by the way, these were lovely kids. And they were really nice. I mean, they want very much to get into middle class society. They were very poor, many of them mixed families, five and six brothers, that kind of things. They were not read to as children. I asked, and I talked to some of the mothers. There simply wasn't time. They had to put food on the table for four or five kids. And what they desperately lacked, Tom, was not just ordinary information, but the desire to find things out. That was what depressed me the most. Curiosity, avidity, look things up, connect one thing to another. They didn't have those habits. And that's something that is a deprivation of poverty. And this is not about race here, what I'm talking about. This is poverty. This would be the same, I'm sure, with white Latino kids. So pulling them into books was harder, but when something struck their personal lives, they would come alive and actually get excited.
Adrian, calling from Suffolk, Virginia. You're on the air with David Denby. Thanks for calling, Adrian.
Yes. Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that my opinion is, I think that the technology can be a hindrance in the classroom, and I think that I think that kids need to be taught from a book, and they need to take the smartphone out. And like when I grew up, I grew up learning, reading those books that he just called off, The Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer.
Me too.
And I enjoyed reading from a book, you know, and it was right there. I could pick it up. And nowadays, you know, kids texting and everything, social media, Facebook. And when you put that in the classroom, then kids are doing everything but reading.
And I guess it's not just in the classroom, Adrian. If that's available the minute they walk out, what are they going to? When are they going to pick up a book instead of going to check in on the latest social networking?
I mean, when you see a commercial, they're advertising towards a kid. I mean, a kid doesn't have a job to buy a phone to afford a phone. That's all you see in the commercials for phones.
Absolutely. I mean, that's where the action is. Adrian, I appreciate your call. What about that competition of the tech? It's right there. It's omnipresent. It's there all the time. Are books just not, you know, up to the competition, David, for attention?
Well, you get, you know, if you're texting and Instagramming and Facebooking, you get an immediate response, or even emailing, that old-fashioned thing that some of us do. You get an immediate response to yourself, and that's very gratifying. I understand it completely. Mm-hmm. You know, reading a book is I think it's a much more profound response, because if you're reading fiction, you start to compare yourself to the characters and the sort of moral and spiritual and physical life of the characters, compare it to your own. It's an inward experience. Look, Tom, I spent my whole life as a movie critic, right? So I know about the immediate response and sensation, and I love being engulfed by a movie. But when I'm sitting and reading at night, it's a more internal experience, and it's much richer. And then there's a whole other question, where there's been a lot of research recently on how much do kids retain of what they read on screens. They tend to read, and me too, tend to read very quickly, looking for keywords, looking for summarizing lines, skip to the bottom of something. And I do this all the time. And I realize afterwards that it's sort of I may think I've taken it all in, but it washes away very quickly. Whereas if you're reading a book, you read backwards and forwards, you turn forward, you turn back, you make notes, you know, it's, pardon the expression, imprints on your brain and is more likely to stay there and fall into your unconscious, whereas that stuff on screen is a wash. It's gone.
Let me ask you about one of these teachers, Sean Leon from the Beacon School, Magnet School in New York City. We're going to talk to Sean in just a second here. Describe what you saw, his technique, his way with students to lead them to reading.
Well, he was assigned what you'd have to call existential texts, that is, things that raise, I mean, very good literature, raise the question of who are you and what are you? Well, we started the year with a story by Faulkner, Rose for Emily, and then we read Hawthorne's Minister's Black Veil, and then they read Orwell and Huxley's dystopian novels, and Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which is a kind of journey into the self.
Oh, yeah.
And we wound up with Dostoevsky and, of all things, Waiting for Godot. Beckett, that's a very challenging list.
So there's the list. What about the technique? How did he open these to students, or open them to?
Well, he would do a little bit of introduction and then just turn to specific passages and ask them what they meant, and then start playing them off against each other. He's very good at pulling them in. They would have to make presentations, stand up in front of the class and illustrate certain themes, and then lead class discussion themselves. But inevitably, he would turn it back to serious, I would say, moral, spiritual, existential questions. What are you doing with your life? Now, that's a pretty demanding thing to say to a 15-year-old. In particular, he was trying to get them to turn off digital media and live. I mean, he put them through a 48-hour fast where they couldn't use any electronic devices at all. And
was that hard?
It was impossible for most of them. 32 kids, three or four got I think it was 10 got through it. The 48 hours. Only three or four read a book, and one said, "I had to read a book." Poor thing.
Give me something.
Poor thing. And Tom, they were not just unplugged; they were unstrung. Many of them.
David Denby's new book is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. We're going to speak with one of those teachers, Sean Leon, from New York City, after a short break here. So many ways to spend time to engage these days. Rihanna with her new Auntie Behind Us, Work featuring Drake there. Hey, you can just tune out to that. Read a book? Maybe, maybe not. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
But I wake up and nothing's wrong. Just get ready for work, 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 work. You send me heavy work, 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 work.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
That it gets to you. I hope that you see this through. I hope that you see this through. What can I say?
Please. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what it takes now to get American teens to read. The books, the teachers, the effort to get to the thrill of good reading in the digital age. New Yorker writer David Denby spent a year in three schools, three classrooms, watching three teachers do the work of breaking through. It can be done, he said, but there's a lot of competition out there. Here's noise and sound from one of those schools, Mamaroneck High School pep rally outside New York. Yeah, and there's a lot of digital distraction, a lot of things that can be done. Do some kids love to read? Sure, some do. Here's a video from Youth Communication, nonprofit, teaches teens to read. One teen talking about why she loves reading.
I like books because I like time to myself. And at the same time, I can experience things without actually doing it sometimes. And I get stressed out a lot. I have a lot of problems, issues. And sometimes reading books, you see characters and you see, you know, people in the books going through the same things. And you're like, oh, yeah, I can relate to that. And, you know, sometimes it helps me, you know, get through the day.
But many don't go there. David Denby writes up the whole experience in his new book, Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. Listeners paying close attention here and responding. Doss writes to us, reading is hard. It takes concentration, focus, brain work. It's the antithesis of daily life today. Ray writes to us, I think that part of it is modeling. If kids see parents reading and enjoying it, they're probably more likely to be inclined toward reading too. Books have a lot of competition these days. Yes, they do. Reason writes to us, my daughter goes to an elementary school here in Maine, encourages reading through choice. Kids can read whatever they want, kitten princesses, dinosaur adventures. All right. Sometimes they don't choose high literature, but by the time they get to high school, they're more open to assigned reading. Let's test that premise. David Denby, stand by there in New York. Also with us right now from New York is one of the teachers that David Denby has followed through this school year. Sean Leon is with us, English teacher at the Beacon School, public magnet school in New York City. Sean Leon, Mr. Leon in school terms, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Is it hard?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. Just as an example, wrapping up Slaughterhouse-Five yesterday was quite a challenge. And starting today, we started The Alchemist, and that was beautifully rewarding. So the emotions are all over the place. Yeah, it's very difficult.
How long have you been teaching, Sean, if I may ask?
This is my 14th year.
14, and has it always been hard, or have you seen a change within those 14 years? It's not like you've been teaching for 40 years.
Right. Yeah, it has always been hard. It's hard across the board. I think it's very difficult for all teachers, regardless of discipline, because of the various things that we are up against.
Do the graybeards in your school say, Sean, you know, it was easier in the old days? Kids just don't relate to reading as much these days. Do you have a sense that there's a generational change here?
Yeah, I don't know that we've ever actually had that conversation specifically, but my sense is that there is. And not trying to attach any judgment here. The world has changed. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be more creative in how we weave into the classroom these things, these screens, and these various technologies that have become a part of our kids' everydayness, if you will. Nevertheless, these things that we try to weave into the classroom are, in fact, in many ways, ironically, what we're up against.
Well, look at what works. What's your sense of what you're up against, Sean, when you're standing in front of the class and you're headed toward a big read? What's going on in your students' minds that may make it more challenging for them to engage today, perhaps, than some years back?
Well, I think And honestly, I don't know that this point here would be that different from days gone by, but what matters? I mean, why does this matter? I think our kids often talk about that in terms of math, but they also consider that question in terms of all disciplines. Like, why does it matter? Why does Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five matter to me? Why does The Alchemist matter to me? If we can answer that question, if I can show them why it matters.
So give us a sense. Slaughterhouse-Five, World War II, long time ago. You know, their grandparents weren't in it.
But that's a great question. But one of the reasons Slaughterhouse-Five is such a brilliant novel is because it's timeless. What Kurt Vonnegut brings up in that novel about the way, of course, this is from Kurt Vonnegut's perspective, right? But the way the poor are treated in our country, that's a question. That's an issue that our students can definitely sink their teeth into. Just recently, we were talking about what was going on in Flint, Michigan, or what is going on in Flint, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see that, yeah, World War II was a long time ago, but war, it's ever-present.
Could I also...
David, please, yes.
Could I just break in, Sean? Hi, it's David.
Hey, David.
One of the things I remember and I wrote about was that the kids had a little trouble realizing how funny Slaughterhouse-Five is, as well as ghastly and frightening. And putting those two things together, that life, you know, could be black comedy and life could be tragedy, and that there could be sort of fun in despair and despair in fun, that's, I think, a very novel new experience for 15-year-olds, and that book pushes them to that kind of realization in a way. And I remember that was that they had a little trouble at first getting that it was all right to laugh at death,
right?
Because Vonnegut's right, always laughing at death. All kinds of things, terrible things happen. I thought that was a wonderful lesson and a real sort of a growth in their, I don't know what other word to use, their maturing is. Into adulthood to know that.
I have to put a point to both of you that people are raising online, and I understand why. I mean, Sean, you got some experience, born in Ireland, grew up in New Orleans, but there you're teaching in New York. And I mean, I haven't reeled off the whole reading list lineup that I've got in front of me here, but Therese says, hey, you know, why no mention of women or writers of color? Rachel said, you know, why do you keep suggesting old white authors for young non-white kids to read? Dickens, Twain, Dostoevsky. What about it? Do you give a representation of the world of literature that reflects these students back to themselves? And can they see themselves in what you're assigning, Sean?
Yeah, that's a good question. And frankly, that's been... there are a number of, I would say, issues that I, as an educator, I'm constantly working on. There's the in-class issue, like how do I more meaningfully weave vocabulary instruction into the class? How do I find literature that is thematically connected to what I do sophomore year that is written by women? We start with Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, by people of color. We do read Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist, and that is something that's ongoing. Nevertheless, I would say, and I think many English teachers would be in agreement with this, great literature, in terms of thematically, representative of the human condition. And so we can read Siddhartha, this inward journey, this quest for the self that is, in fact, not gender-specific, that is, in fact, not race-specific. What's key, though, is that we cannot, I got to say, as an educator, as an English teacher, I don't think I can simply teach Siddhartha on Siddhartha's terms, meaning I can't simply go into a classroom and break Siddhartha down according to devices and elements and have it end at that. The key, then, is to help students of varying genders and races see how this journey is in fact reflective of their journey in so many ways. And that is, I think, one of the keys to getting kids excited about reading again, just to show them that it is relevant. And I would argue that you can take any novel, any era, and show any student that this is relevant. This is important, but I also have to give my students an opportunity to share their story that parallels the story of Santiago and the Alchemist, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. It's great. And if you can do it, bravo. But still, people may wonder, well, whose life? Whose perspective? I mean, when I look across the list you've included at the back of the book, David, I mean, I see, you know, here's Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and Ralph Ellison and Amy Tan and Khalid Hosseini. But
oh, these are other classes.
Yeah, no, other classes. Explain. But Juno Diaz, yeah. I'm just saying, across these lists that you're offering. And yet, you know, our culture, I mean, you wrote about it in great books years ago now. We know the shoulders that it stands on. There are a lot of white male shoulders in there. Is that an issue? Is that an impediment?
Well, can I just answer? I mean, part answer, and I think Sean has already said the most important part. He's passionate about what he teaches, and he can bring that alive for those kids. And that, whether, you know, it's representative of gender or race, that's a secondary issue to the passion the teacher brings in bringing that text alive and making it relate to their own lives, getting them to open up and connect their own lives to the stories they're reading. That's, I think, what Sean was saying, and I saw that in action. I mean, a reading list is not representative democracy. That was the issue in my Western Classics book. What you're doing here is building a base for kids to stand on, and they can apply what they learn reading one book to another book. And that what you want to create is that hunger for reading and for finding it relevant to your life. If it's a good book, if it's a fascinating book, if it's a relevant book, it's going to work for them across gender and across. I didn't hear any, by the way, about women. I didn't hear any of the girls in the class, and I talked to a lot of them, complain that there were no women authors. They were excited about what they were reading.
All right. I got a lot of listeners waiting to chime in here, if I may. Pax in Augusta, Georgia. You're on the air with Sean Leon and David Denby. Thanks for calling, Pax.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. We live in Augusta, Georgia, but we moved here about a year and a half ago from New Orleans. My kids read constantly. They're two boys. My eldest is 13. My youngest is 9. Just this morning, my little one was halfway to the car and came running back saying, "Mom, I don't have a book. I need a book," because he'd forgotten to bring a book in the car. So, you know, and the thing is I've noticed in New Orleans, it was popular for the kids to read. A book would go through the school like wildfire, and everyone had to read it. But here in Augusta, Georgia, there seems to be less of a culture of reading. If kids do read, they don't talk about it. It's not something that they're excited about publicly or proud of. So
that's interesting.
How did your kids get to this stage? That's what I'd like to know. Where did that hunger come from?
Well, I imagine that we inculcated them with the culture of reading. How I did it.
You read to them when they were infants.
Sure, and when we weren't reading to them, there were always books on tape. They had their own little tape recorder, and when we were in the car, they would listen to the Harry Potter books endlessly and the Lord of the Rings and, you know, on cassette.
And the hunger is set, the hunger for those books.
So it's stored. They love stories. That's it. I mean, they just have to get to the end of a story.
Oh, gosh, yes. And they read them in different ways. My eldest gets mad at my youngest because my youngest, when he opens the book, he's the one who goes to the end of the story all the time. He opens it up and goes to the end.
Don't tell him not to do that with 1984.
Right, not with 1984. Don't cheat. Pax, it's great, and we're glad for you. But she points out there, David, she found, anyway, a difference in reading enthusiasm in different communities. Did you see that in your? I mean, you're in three different schools, three different communities. Do you sense a different levels?
Yeah, well, the upper middle class, white, mainly white suburb of Mamaroneck, New York, which is about 30 miles north of New York, a so-called bedroom community. These were kids from professional families, and there were a lot of books in the house. So the best students there were fabulous. But as I started to say before, there were many kids, particularly boys, who were simply not doing the reading. They were simply brazening their way through with spark notes and everything. So what they're doing at Mamaroneck, not the only place in the world that's doing it, is quite different. They're not giving up on The Great Gatsby and Macbeth in 1984 in 10th grade, but they're also letting them read what they want at a given moment. They have to have a book of their own choosing. It can be from the library, it can be from home, but they must have a book going at all time. They want to develop that hunger. The notion is there's a lot of research behind this. If you enjoy what you're reading, even if it's just a young adult novel, you know, or something like that, another dystopian thing, then you will continue reading and you'll read the next one. That's part one. Part two is getting, laddering them up to read more challenging things. So if a kid is reading horror novels, you know, or graphic novels with horror all the time, you could have a little conference and you say, look, there was this guy named Edward Allan Poe who wrote these really spooky tales. And there was Robert Louis Stevenson who wrote, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or whatever. And so, and I have some stories like this. You ladder them up to more serious stuff, taking their interests as the beginning.
But start somewhere. Laura writes to us, in third grade, maybe a beginning. I stayed up all night reading Charlotte's Web, a gift from my teacher.
There
I
you
could
go.
Not put it down. I did not foresee Charlotte's death, and still glad I read it, I sobbed myself to sleep.
Oh.
Elijah, no less, is calling from Dorchester, New Hampshire. Elijah, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I am about 13 years old, and I love reading. It's one of my favorite things to do. I have to go be in my room at 7 o'clock. So I have a bookshelf, basically a whole wall that's full of books, and I'll just pull out a book, and they're all just so amazing. They all have meaning, and each word can be powerful. One of my favorite books that I've read in the past is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne.
Oh, yeah.
The original copy. It was an amazing book. I was pretending that I was Captain Nemo, and then I would be the harpoonist, and just so crazy.
Elijah,
can I ask you?
Yeah, quickly. We're right there with you. Our time is short, David.
Do your friends find this habit of yours strange? How do they relate to this habit?
Well, since I live in a small town, I know that a lot of my friends enjoy reading too, but I know that a lot of, it's about 50-50, I'd say, at my old school anyways, that 50% of my friends were playing video games at night, and the other 50% was reading books.
Elijah, you're terrific, and you stay right on that track, and our imaginations are fired up right alongside yours all over again, and I really appreciate your call. Sean Leon, teaching there at the Beacon School in New York City, we wish you the best of luck. We're really interested to see what you've shared in your classroom with David Denby, and we thank you so much for joining us for a minute today. Thank you, Mr. Leon.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And David Denby, thanks as always for your work. The new book is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 books that can change lives. It's really more than 24, but who's counting?
Who's counting?
David Denby, thanks
lifetime
so much.
Lifetime habit.
Yeah, lifetime.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being with us today. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Have a good read. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.